to number two, and thereafter the three, all which basically centered around the overview by the content advisor Dr. Black, and then the presentation on offers used by the departments that we have, and then thereafter we then have a discussion. Without being lost of time, let me give over to the content advisor Dr. Black to lead the charge. Over to you, Dr. Black.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and members. My presentation will be brief today. So the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill was passed by the National Assembly, transmitted to the NCLP for concurrence and referred to the Select Committee on the 27th of September 2022. The department briefed the committee on the bill on 15 March 2025 and on 26 March 2023, my apologies, an advert was placed in national media calling for written submissions on the bill with a deadline of 24 April 2023. The committee will today hear oral submissions on the bill, and on the 14th of June, the department will be afforded opportunity to respond to the written submissions. The objects of the bill is to consolidate the economic regulation of transport within a single framework and policy, to establish the transport economic regulator, to establish the Transport Economic Council, to make consequential amendments to various other acts, and to provide for related incidental matters. Input was received from the Western Cape Department of Mobility, who is with us today, will be doing the oral submission. Input was also received from Drs. S. Miller and M. Miller, Dr. S. Miller being a senior research fellow at the Johannesburg Institute of Advanced Studies, and Dr. E. Miller being at the University of Witwatersrand. Submissions were also received from Transnet Limited, the South African Bus Operators Association, and a joint submission by the Gauteng Transport Authority, Gautrain Management Agency, and the Gauteng Department of Roads and Transport. The presenters in green all being with the committee today to do the oral submissions. Okay, so all that is left is to provide an overview of the written submissions of Drs. Miller, who will not be doing their submission today. Drs. Miller, essentially, chairperson and members, do not support the bill in its entirety. And there are four main reasons for this. The first one being that the main issues within the transport sector have very little to do with price regulation and is therefore unlikely to be resolved by it. So a lot of the inputs center on the need for public management and governance within the transport sector as a whole, and that being a root cause for a number of the challenges that is being faced by the sector. So they say, for example, that adding the single transport economic regulator and associated regulatory structures will add cost and complexity without solving any of the fundamental problems in the sector. They're also of the view that given that key operators in the sector are state entities, the state as it is already has the necessary power to determine prices without creating a special separate entity or regulator to do so. So some of the fundamental problems, or what they call the dysfunctionality within the transport sector, for example, failing infrastructure, deteriorating rolling stock, safety problems on the train, etc., will remain even where private operators are now allowed on the infrastructure. They would, in their argument, essentially have to operate in the exact same environment. The second reason for why they do not support the bill is that price regulation, related to the challenges in the sector, the state already has the power to resolve the challenges, and that the failure to make the necessary decisions will not be remedied by introducing the regulator. So from their vantage point, their argument is that the problem is that the state or the shield in this case has not been willing to take difficult decisions to follow through. And the challenge there is that enabling that ending high tariffs would also mean reducing Transnet's ability to cross-subsidize loss-making operations and operate without greater efficiency or state support, for example. So their view is introducing the state will not resolve this on its own, because the state itself is also a public regulator that will require a public mandate and associated cooperation and support from the shareholder. So in summary, without the political will to do so, the regulator is neither necessary nor sufficient to solve the root causes within the sector, in their view. The second last reason, Chair, the broad regulatory model for that would be used as not work in other sectors. And the user electricity sector as an example. So they draw on the 2012 assessment done for the National Development Plan that at that time already found that the regulatory agencies had not performed as envisioned. So they use the example of the regulatory model that underlies the National Energy Regulator. That despite that provisions in their view have failed to make appropriate tariff allocations to ESCOM, as demonstrated by the late rapid escalation in electricity tariffs. The last one is that the regulatory model requires scarce resources and skills, which the country either does not have or could at least be better utilized. So drawing on the socioeconomic impact assessment that was done when the bill was introduced, the estimates are that the stay will cost between 78 million and 133 million rand, requiring between 90 and 145 relatively highly qualified staff. And it is the opinion of the of Professor Miller that this is not a progressive allocation of resources, especially in the post-COVID era. Then the last one, Chair, is that in their view, there are simple models that have been successful elsewhere that could be used to improve management in the transport sectors. And here they use the example of the water sector, which has been performing fairly well in their assessment. And where the notion of introducing a regulatory authority has also been raised in the past. As I said, without an independent regulator, you can summarize the water provision by bulk prices that are set by national government departments using historical legislation. The department in this instance calculates the tariffs and consults with major stakeholders, and these including municipalities and big users such as ESCOM, CESO, and other well-organized agriculture. Price increases in such a model have to be in greater than inflation, has to be justified in electronic platforms. And when making the comparisons, they come to the summation, Chair, that unlike the electricity case, the system has worked reasonably well, and tariffs have increased smoothly and predictably, and user participation in this model keeps government on the same calculation. Thank you, Chair. So that is the only submission we received. We persons will not be doing the actual oral submission today. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honorable members and guests.
Thank you, Dr. Clark, for the overview from Dr. Miller. Let's then go back to the agenda and then receive the oral submission from the Southern African Business Operators Association, led by Mr. B. Govender. Does Mr. Govender have the hosting rights?
Yes, Chair.
Yes, let Mr. Govender take the podium now.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to your Chair and colleagues and everybody present. Can you hear me clearly?
Very so.
I'm about to start hearing screen. If you will tell me that from your side, it's all good.
Yes, we can see the screen, Mr. Governor.
Okay. So, once again, good morning, colleagues, and all protocols.
Recording in progress.
My name is Basil Govender, as introduced, an industry representative, and today presenting to you on behalf of the Southern African Bus Operators Association. Our thanks to the committee and the organizers, and on behalf of SABOA and the bus and coach industry. So this oral submission and representation is purely with a view from the bus and coach industry. Just on that note, to draw attention to the committee and the House, that the bus and coach sector broadly encompasses many subsectors. We have contracted subsidized operators flowing from both the PTOG and EPNG segmented funding. Then you've got scholar, learner, tourism, and charter services, intercity and long distance, cross-border, and commercially contracted services operating within the bus and coach industry. So, Chair, on the screen presentation, we'll summarize the main areas for deliberation and for and this touches on the submission that we've made in writing as well to the committee. So in terms of the views of the industry broadly encompassed and collated, the view of the industry with regard to the ERT bill is that the bill is broadly aimed at all sectors. And primarily, this is aimed at ending specialized sector regulators, as it is written very broadly in a catch-all manner. And flowing from that, we believe it could and may very well have unintended consequences for the contracted subsidized commuter bus industry, as this industry has and should continue to have exclusive geographical and commercial operating rights, because these are embedded in the contracts as they are currently designed, and they're also embedded in the contracts upon award. It's important to note that the nature of contracting in the subsidized commuter bus industry is premised on competition for the market and not competition in the market. And that's a distinct difference when you interrogate it. We have entities entering into a 7 or 12 year contract, and upon award of the contract, they earn the contractual right to solely operate the subsidized service for the duration of the contract. And this is in accordance with contract obligations, Chair and the House. Speaking a bit more about contracting agreements, by default, the contracting agreement then creates an environment where successful operators will have market dominance, if you look at it in the pure terminology as far as bus services are concerned. Then this therefore brings to the fore the applicability of this bill to the subsidized bus commuter industry. And with that, applicability comes a litany of concerns. They've been tabled in detail with the submission sent, but SABOA is of the view that the subsidized commuter industry should be exempt from the market dominance definition. And we say that for the following reasons. The industry is already heavily regulated by the contracting system, and that's done through the contracting authorities, or either the provinces or the local authorities, or a combination of them through intergovernmental agreements that have been signed. And amongst others, the contracts and the processes specify passenger fares per kilometer, annual percentage fare increases, networks to be operated, and quality of services and or measurement thereof. And the CAs formally monitor the activities to ensure contract compliance. This is done directly or via appointed agency. They also prescribed financial and operating reporting requirements, and this is to ensure compliance with the statutory and regulatory aspects set out in the contract. And these are submitted to the contracting authorities within strict and agreed frameworks as set out in the contract documents. In respect of this bill and the proposals, many of these requirements then overlap with the information requirements that are being proposed and would be required by the regulator. For example, if an investigation into an entity is envisaged, it is done by the current contracting authority and would, as proposed in the bill, be done by the regulator as well. Further, Chair, to you, there appears to be significant overlap with the functions of the Competition Commission, as the Commission also focuses, amongst many other things, on dominance and dominant firms. However, we do acknowledge that this may be addressed in discussions between the two entities and resolved as to where jurisdictions lie. It is conceivable, however, that many complex cases will come before the regulator, and therein lies some of the conundrums we are talking about now, which in the professor's previous presentation, we also raised the issue of resources around competencies and capacitation. In order for the regulator to review and set down decisions within a reasonable time frame, this would require well-balanced competencies and capacities to deliver. There would also be a critical requirement to avoid prejudicing any regulated entity and or triggering any financial impacts by the timing and the decisions that are made from the regulator. So this observation is based on the long timelines that are referenced, and you can see that detail in our comments submitted. Further concern center around the powers envisaged for the regulator, i.e. to set and adjust rates, fares, returns on investments, etc. The cautionary or the concern would be if this power is exercised incorrectly, it can result in damaging, detrimental financial hardship to regulated entities and by extension to the sustainability of public transport. And further to that, regulated entities, by extensions to rights, should therefore have mechanisms available to them to either challenge or sue the regulator for any hardships where financial harm arises from wrongful regulatory decisions or decisions that are not reversed or amended timeously as contemplated under Section 12.1. In talking to some of the specific aspects around the bill, and I've referenced in there, and this is in the detail as well, in Part B, where Part B and Subclause C, we believe from a common point of view that these objectives are normally pursued in the public transport contracting system via the contracted stipulations. Now, it poses the question, how will these requirements then translate or dovetail with the objective set out in the bill for the regulator? And in Part B2, where the purpose of the act is, of this act are to be pursued in a manner that promotes the development of small and medium enterprises, fully agreed and fully concurred. However, again, these requirements are well covered in the current contracting regime to the extent that the current model tender documents have prescribed a set aside of 30% for the total value of the contracts awarded to the winning bidder and towards the development and promotion of small and medium enterprises. So it is proposed here that the focus should be on the entire industry and not necessarily larger businesses with a focus to onerous impositions on them. Chair, then in terms of the application of the Act, Section 44 and A, we are commenting that by definition, when a commuter bus contract is awarded to a public transport contractor for 7 to 12 years, whether it be tendered or negotiated, the operator will have market power by virtue of the design of the contract and the system implementation. By that, I mean no other operator is allowed to compete with this operator, as the market entry is regulated through a permit system and the routes are defined and allocated. So in terms of what the application of the Act is proposing, we say that these stipulations will have far-reaching implications for the NDOT and or flow-through of the competitive tender system that is based on competition for the market and not in the market. In terms of determination of price controls, Chair, again, very bus and coach centric response. The charges levied upon passengers transported by the subsidized commuter operations are regulated already, and they are regulated via the contracting regime, and they are prescribed via the contract award and the basis and the escalations and the indices to be used and factored in. So the question we would ask is, how does Section 11.2A, how will the 11.2A be applied in this case? Further comments on the determination of price controls with regards to 11.1. Again, we draw reference that the charges levied upon passengers transported by the commuter transport are prescribed. That's just a duplication there. My apologies. Going to the next one. This, we believe, is a pretty drastic intervention and measure where we're saying every regulated entity is subject to price regulation in accordance to with a price control as determined by the regulator. We believe this is a drastic measure. It could have some unintended consequences or intended in terms of deterring investments and entrepreneurship. The market determines tariffs in a competitive economy. And as a regulator, we believe that the regulator can never be fully informed of all factors determining investment decisions, venture capital projects that result in prices for facilities, resources, services, and or returns for investment on investment. The more serious unintended consequences, Chair, and for the House, for investments in the transportation sector by the private sector is the impact both locally and internationally. These measures can be seen as just another hindrance, obstacle to investment in the industry, and at a point when we are seeking injection both local and internationally from investors to stimulate economy and growth, and to grow employment in the sector, it probably may be counterproductive. And then some of the obvious questions that pop out is, what if the regulator gets it wrong, regulates a too low price tariff or a too high price or return, and that impact on the entity could be dire to the extent that it could cease to exist. And more importantly, in a very stringent macroeconomic and microeconomic climate from an industry point of view, financiers are more detailed in their scrutiny now, so that the risk there is that financiers will more carefully consider business plans if prices, tariffs, returns are to be determined by what they deem as an external party to the relationship, i.e. a regulator. And finally, when does a regulator get involved? Might help develop the discussion. Is it prior to consideration of investments or afterwards? So our proposals and recommendations is to consider the limits on the scope on the part of the regulator for intervention. Unlimited scope to intervene in the market may have detrimental consequences for investments. And we do acknowledge that regulators have a role to play with regards to monopoly enterprises, such as AXA, ports, navigation services, etc. But in this context, and from a bus and coach industry, there should be limitations of involvement in the economy in general, as this section intends to achieve direct involvement in the economy. Further comments on the price controls shared through you. We are asking some very specific questions around 11.2 again, A, B, C, and D. At what stage will this happen in the contracting process, and will it be correlated in terms of the contracting process? Because contracting authorities issue tenders for services to be provided, as we said, that include prescribed fares, routes, timetables, bus characteristics, and many other deliverables. So also contracting authorities determine the fare basis based on historical trends, historical fares, and cognizant of economic and social circumstances geographically based to the contract. These prescribed fares are considered a critical revenue source when a company prepares a bid for the contracting chair. They form an essential part of the top line. So all the revenue risks are residing with the company or the entity. And any interference afterwards could have a material impact on the viability of the operations and also cause major uncertainty, not only for the operator, but for its entire value chain. And in from an industry perspective, we've often found that service level changes tend to be heavily politicized in practice and very difficult to achieve in reality. So feeding into the professor's presentation comments early on, we believe this section adds another layer of uncertainty in the commuter and bus contracting system. And share for the committee, we have already had 3 decades of uncertainty, and we are still in an uncertain environment. And now another layer of uncertainty is being brought into the frame. The direct inference and intention to get involved with finances of operating companies post the contracting process may rear some degrees of unacceptable responses and or challenges, and we need to be cognizant of that. And then from an administrative and reporting structure, currently and visits in the contract and the model contract documents and the NLTA, operators are required to prepare and report on a schedule of operational and financial information to the contracting authority. These are all set out in the contracts. Now, the regulator becomes another institution requiring the same or slightly amended information, and this will cause a higher administrative burden, as implied by those subsections A to D. Chair? In terms of further comments on the determination of price controls, Chair, through you, Chair, 11.7. We are asking, is this not a function of the contracting authority and or the Department of Transport? Because that's clearly defined. And would it not be then a duplication of processes, which then again creates further policy uncertainty in terms of public transport, road-based passenger? Then in terms of 11.10 and the 3 sub-clauses, again, we're saying these measures will add a significant cost and effort to doing business in the country, as well as risk of potential investments current and in future. Given the highly uncertain environment and post 3 decades of uncertainty, we need to create certainty. That should be the objective. That certainty will create sustainability and growth. And for us, we believe that the administrative burden of complying with these measures under 11.10 A to C will be significant, And again, we believe that this is layering a duplication. And as we have mentioned elsewhere, in terms of powers, the Competition Commission already has the powers to investigate any market dominance abuse by any contracted firm. And again, here, this seems to be a duplication of what the Commission would be dealing with. So talking about the timelines and the long envisaged processes that would unfold, and as you read it there, within 15 days of receipt of price deviation requests contemplated in Section 10, regulator may, within 60 days, business days, review the impact and propose price deviation and determine whether to approve it or not. So effectively, that means 75 days, excluding holidays and weekends, which may make it even longer, will be the maximum response time while the affected entity has to carry on its operations, not knowing what decision would unfold in 75 days. This is, of course, again, for major uncertainty. And the emphasis on may within 60 days is further cause for concern. It could take longer. If not, how much longer? So we are proposing a revision to a shorter turnaround time with strict limitations for responses from the regulator, which would then define periods of interaction and feedback. In terms of the information required from regulated entities, Chair, that talks to 13.1 A to D. I said it already, but just for highlighting the impact, this again is a virtual duplication of information that's already being submitted to contracting authorities. And then flowing from that is, you know, what would the regulator do with it, and who will be the institution that controls the regulated entity, the CA or the economic regulator? Because there now appears to be two formal and compulsory reporting lines. And if responses are not consistent, there could be conflicting responses and directives from both parties. So our proposal is that the regulation of bus contracts should reside with the contracting authority. And we believe Section 13.1 unnecessarily duplicates this activity, which might talk to a streamlined structure and competency and capacity if we eliminate some of this duplication for the regulator. And if at all, and it is a part of the process for the regulator implementable, we propose that the contracted bus commuter services should be exempt from this requirement. So, Jay, in terms of the direct price control reduction, and this is the last point I would talk to. The total annual financial cost of reduction to the regulated entity may not exceed more than 10% of the entity's annual turnover of its regulated business during the entity's preceding financial year. We believe that this threshold seems high, and it could have a material impact on the entity's financial sustainability. We would like, if necessary and applicable, a discussion as to how that number was determined. Because as it stands in the environment, margins in the contracted bus commuter contracting systems are very slim. By nature of the capped funding for public transport, it calls for absolute pencil sharp costing with narrow margins and tight management and efficiencies. And these are set in a bid process. So looking for further reduction or further price control reductions will severely threaten sustainability. And then further to that, how will the regulator respond after reducing tariffs or amending returns on investment percentages of entities? Should then such an entity embark on a cost reduction process, which is inevitable? It's a forced process of saying we have no option but to reduce labor, delay investment, and capex injections. That all has a multiplier effect. So the proposal here would be that directed at reducing tariffs and returns on investment of a regulated entity cut to the heart of a business model. This is a too high percentage and should be reconsidered on further discussion. And Chair, through you, I wish to thank you and the House for the time and the opportunity to make oral submissions on behalf of the industry. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Govinda, for more for the presentation. We appeal to the members to note the procedural questions that they have, and then after we have received all the presentation, provide an opportunity to the members to seek clarification questions from the presentations. Let's hold our horses. And then move to item number 4 on the agenda, which is the presentation from the three agencies, Gauteng Transport Authority, Gauteng Management Agency, and Gauteng Department of Roads and Transport. Mr. Dougs, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and good morning to you and to Honourable members of the committee. I'm just going to share my screen.
What that members, the guests will speak just for the public purposes, just to show their face so that the public can relate to you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And let me introduce myself because I am representing the three entities. My name is William Dax. I'm the CEO of the Gautrain Management Agency, and I present the apologies from the head of department and the CEO of the Transport Authority in making my presentation. Chair, I'm going to launch into the presentation. Is my screen visible?
Yes, it is visible, Mr. Dax. Thank you.
In the interest of time, we have separated our submission and our presentation into two parts. So noting that we have only 15 minutes, I'm going to cover what we're calling the general high-level comments, but I would ask that the detailed slides which follow on the specific comments also be taken into account. Thank you, Chair. Yes, so at a high level, I think we from the Gauteng Provincial Government acknowledge that the overarching need is for an efficient and cost-effective public transport system, and that will drive economic growth. And as such, we welcome and support the bill in principle. However, Chair, we need to be very careful to state that we also are concerned about the potential unintended consequences that could flow from its implementation as currently drafted. By way of context, the GMA, that's us at Gautrain, the Transport Authority, and the Gauteng Department of Roads and Transport, we operate primarily in the arena of public transport as opposed to the movement of goods and commodities. And we see the need to strike a very careful balance between achieving the need for efficient and cost-effective public transport systems with just making sure that the regulation actually works and achieves these objectives. As I said, we come from a public transport background, but we also are involved in a number of public-private partnerships. And I think it's very important that we all acknowledge that there's another policy imperative in this country, and that is to bridge what people call the infrastructure gap. In other words, the amount of infrastructure that is required versus that which can actually be funded from budget or balance sheets of state-owned entities. And in South Africa and in the transport sector, this gap is enormous. And there's been a number of policy imperatives and statements that said we will look to the private sector for such investment. And in fact, this is supported by the National Treasury through the various PFMA-related regulations. Now, these forms of private sector investment, they come for with advantages. And I think we've listed some of these. We get private sector investment. We get risk transfer for life cycle costs. And we get to know what our contingent liability and budget requirements are. But in exchange for this advantage comes a requirement for certainty. And this is certainty around sustainable income or funding of the project. And again, not to dwell too much on it, I think we have to acknowledge the balance between asking the private sector to come in and run services and invest in our infrastructure and the income which will come from that. So this is where, hypothetically, we could have an economic regulator for transport who comes in and says that where there is, and particularly I'm referring to public transport share, there is a need to change the fares that are charged to users. And I think we're all aware that public transport is a subsidized service in this country in all regards except the minibus taxi industry. And the moment that we change that user pay amount, we impact on the amount which is required from the government entities. And in this case, should it apply to the provincial government, it would come through to the Gauteng Provincial Treasury and to the Gauteng Department of Roads and Transport. Section 11 of the Act tries to deal with this. I think it's Section 5, and it requires that there be consultation with the subsidizing party, but we feel that this is too light, and consultation is limited to areas such as coordination of budget cycles, changes to service levels, etc., and not necessarily taking into account the financial constraints of the departments and entities. So we recommend, Chair, that the bill be absolutely explicit in whether it is applicable to public transport and PPP projects, and if so, how. Our reading of Section 4.1 is that it probably does not apply to public transport as a regulated entities at the moment, but under Section 4.2 and subsequent provisions, it could become applicable to it. Hence, we also asking for acknowledgement of the importance of striking the balance between the user pay principle and government subsidy, bearing into account this imperative of providing long-term certainty to private sector players. On the question of access, we would like to highlight that we are not seeing a strong linkage between access to rail networks with consultation with relevant regulators. And in this regard, we would specifically refer to the railway safety regulator, and there has to be a balance between equitable access and safe and reliable operations. We also had a lack of clarity around the envisaged relationship with the Competition Commission. I think that has been raised. I will not dwell on it. We do note that the bill could play a role in decongestion and promote modal shift from road to rail. However, this would require some work and further exploration in terms of road network charges and whether the road network would ever be under some form of economic regulation. Jeremy raised two comments around the information. There's an enormous amount of information requirement, and our query relates to whether there's clarity on public access to this information, noting that there may be some confidentiality requirements. Okay, then we also note that there are a number of references to implementation phases and issuance of regulations. We're not clear as to what these phases are and how they'll be defined. So I think, again, just from a practical point of view, what are the timelines and phases that we will be looking at. Chair, I'm going to stop there. There are, as I indicated, further slides relating to specific comments, but these are intended from our submission to be useful to the drafters. And I think our general presentation will suffice for today in terms of the select committee. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dux, for the presentation. Let's then again follow the same approach in terms of what we said earlier on around clarity to question. The next presentation then will be from Advocate Kotia. From Transnet.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and members of the committee. I'm Sandra Kutsia, the Chief Legal Officer of Transnet. I will be sharing my presentation responsibilities with my colleague, Dr. Andrew Shaw. Also present in the meeting from Transnet is Mr. Kapai Pahla Mukhraka, who is standing in as the acting Chief Executive Officer of Transnet for Ms. Borsha Darby. I'll also be joined by Ms. Dineshni Govender and Mr. Mondi Nkhole. Chairperson, as has been indicated, Transnet did provide prior written and verbal submissions to Parliament on this bill, and we wish to thank the committee for an opportunity to again present to you our key concerns associated with this bill. In view of our earlier submissions to Parliament, we would in particular today want to focus on aspects associated with price control regulation as it relates to rail freight transportation. My colleague, Dr. Andrew Shaw, will in particular provide the context and implication concerns as it relates to economically sustaining the rail infrastructure and fair competition in terms of railway operations. Mr. Chairperson, it just so happens that a number of the other generic concerns that Transnet has with regard to this bill have been touched on by the previous speakers. So we will limit our presentation on that. However, I will still cover aspects that we believe requires further emphasis. I will then, in considering the time allocated to Transnet, suggest that my colleague spends about 10 to 12 minutes on the aspects particularly associated with price control regulation, and I will then address the particular emphasis that Transnet would like to place on certain generic aspects and also for the benefit of the committee. Honourable Chairperson, before we proceed with the crux of the presentation, Transnet does want to just emphasise that we support the principle of economic regulation on the basis that it's applied fairly and consistently across the transport sector. Thus, we support the consolidation of economic regulation of transport within a single framework, policy, and a single regulator. We also support the establishment of the regulator as a function to sign off on prices, tariffs, track access as imposed on regulated entities. We support the separation of rail infrastructure and operations, and also the regulation of the infrastructure manager with responsibility to provide access and invest in the rail network infrastructure. We support the regulation of fair access to the rail network, and we support the regulation of access fees. You will note from our comments later on in the presentation, we do have, however, serious concern as to areas of uncertainty not addressed in the ERT bill, which we believe, if not addressed, will result in potential structural imbalances and will affect the economic sustainability of the rail network and services in the best interest of the country. Honourable Chairperson, at this point in time, I would like to hand over to my colleague, Dr. Shaw, to address the slides 2-7, and therefore thereafter I will then address the more generic issues. Dr. Shaw, if I can hand over to you.
Good morning, Chairperson, and two members of the committee. If I can just start by acknowledging the presence of a number of board members in the meeting. So thank you very much for your support. And then I will just present a few slides before handing back to Advocate Kutsia. If I could ask if we could go to the next slide. Advocate Kutsia has already presented this. So essentially, Transnet is the custodian of rail, ports and pipelines. And what we see is a shift towards how we deal with the network or the infrastructure component relative to the operations component, with the infrastructure component, say, in the form of the National Ports Authority, playing an oversight and a regulatory role, with operations separated and operated by Transnet, but also by a number of other players. You can also see our involvement in a number of other related network industries, Transnet pipelines, and we'll talk to that, as well as a big scope of oversight around Transnet property. If we can go to the next slide, please. So what I would like to do, Chairperson, is raise our principal area of concern. And I will show a few slides that support our rationale for a change to this particular area. And then I'll head back to Advocate Kutsia, who will raise a number of final areas that she had already initiated in her introduction. In respect of our one area of key concern, which relates to Section 11 for Section 5, and I read it in the middle of the slide, it says, any reasonable cost differentials between different types of facilities or services provided or arising due to geographic location or any other characteristic that the regulator may deem relevant would be taken into account in terms of the pricing of infrastructure on the rail system for multiple operators. Now, our key concern around this relates to the fact that giving an ability to create differential prices for different geographic locations means that the integrity of the railway network is potentially unprotected, and that some users of the system or some operators on the system in the future will benefit over in a much greater way than some of the other operators who may lose. And as a consequence of this, we'll lose network integrity, and we are very likely to lose the ability of rail to move manufactured products, containers, automotives, and agriculture, and that is of some concern. So I'll expand on this as we go into one or two of the slides, just in terms of how the pricing principle would work in other jurisdictions. So if you look at the principle or the paragraph at the very bottom of the slide, is that a common principle applied globally is that all the costs of the network, the railway network, are put into a single pool, and that becomes the regulated asset base. And that terminology is now very commonly applied in a number of sectors. And it's currently applied in three key sectors, two of which we are very, very close to, in airports, in ports, and in pipelines. So in the airport sector, the costs of operating all of South African airports are included in their regulatory asset base. And the pricing for those airports is then allocated to the users of such airports, principally the customers, but the airlines specifically. And the consequence of this is that within the regulated asset base is that the smaller airports are effectively supported by the revenue streams of the larger airports. Exactly the same happens in respect of ports. And in our example, we know that the Port of Durban generates sufficient revenue to partly cover the additional costs of the Port of Mossel Bay, which is much smaller. And exactly the same principle applies in pipelines. The challenge with creating a clause which provides for specific geographic location differential in pricing means that you can unwind this integrity of having all of the infrastructure in one pool, and it means that some users in some geographic locations will potentially will benefit and others will lose. So if we go to the next slide, please. I'm not going to focus on a lot of what's in this slide, only to say that as we go forward, Transnet Freight Rail will be separated into an infrastructure manager and a train operating company. The infrastructure manager will be responsible for the infrastructure, and this is in terms of the white paper, which aligns very closely to the ERT bill. And the train operating company will be Transnet Freight Rail, but it will in future include a number of other train operating companies. The cost for the infrastructure manager, in our view, would be held by a regulatory asset base. In other words, a pooling of all the costs across the railway network. And these will then be allocated in the form of track access charges or tariffs to each of the train operating companies. If we go to the next slide, please. We have taken our network, the TFR network, and we've identified the bulk mineral corridors, the core rail network, which is largely the intercity links and the links into SADC, and then the feeder rail network, which is the feeder system that supports that core rail network and the bulk mineral corridors. I won't again talk to all the elements that are in this slide, but just to, for the sake of the committee, to demonstrate that we've done a lot of work in establishing how we would sustain the integrity of the rail network in such a way that it serves the needs of all operators that operate across that network. So in the next slide, if I can go there, what you will see is that if we take the bulk minerals corridor on the left-hand side at the bottom, you'll see in red, you'll see it makes up about 11% of the kilometers or distance of our network. The core freight network makes up about 25%, and the feeder system makes up 25%, and the very smaller part of the feeder system makes up 37% of the network. If you then look at our current volumes, that's TFR is for Transnet Freight Rail, you'll see the bulk of our volumes sit on the bulk corridors. A lesser portion of those volumes sit on the core network, and then a very small amount sit on the feeder network. If we do our assessment of rail addressable demand, which is the amount of demand that we believe should be carried by rail, you can see that the implication of this is that much more should be carried on the core network as well as the feeder network. The basis for creating a geographical separation in pricing means that the bulk mineral corridors would benefit and the core freight network and feeder system would not benefit by a principle of geographic separation in pricing. So let me give you an example. If we have a grain train that uses a smaller part of the network and there's only two trains operated a day, based on a geographic principle, those two trains would have to share the cost of that infrastructure for that day. So that means that the cost of that infrastructure would be separated 50-50, and each of the trains operated that day would be charged the full cost of that infrastructure to operate those two trains. If we take some of the bulk minerals corridors, which have very intensive operations, And we have, say, 10 trains operating on one of those corridors. The cost of that infrastructure would be divided in such a way that 10% of the cost would be allocated to each of the trains on that particular corridor, on that particular geographic part of the network. The result of that is that the bulk minerals corridors will benefit from this geographical principle in pricing, and the core freight and the feeder system will disbenefit. In other words, the areas that are less utilized but provide network integrity will end up paying higher relative costs than the bulk corridors. And our analysis demonstrates that the losers in this would be container flows, automotive, where we're moving cars across the network, agriculture, manufactured products, and those kind of smaller parts of the network which serve the smaller cities and metros across South Africa. And so from that standpoint, we would like the concept of geographical pricing to be removed from the ERT bill. I'm going to hand back to Advocate Kotsia, if I could, to deal with the final few elements of the presentation. Thank you very much.
Advocate? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. If we could turn to slide 8. Chairperson, to the extent that certain aspects of and detail of the slides have already been addressed, I will only focus on areas of emphasis. And let me start by indicating that Transnet shares the concerns of previous speakers as it relates to areas of uncertainty and duplication of regulatory frameworks. It is our view that from a regulatory consistency perspective, the regulation of all models and modes of transport must be underpinned over and above the provisions of the bill by legislation that reflects the principles, criteria, and considerations that are unique to the relevant market being regulated. While the bill recognizes the continued existence of legislation for the regulation of certain infrastructure and services, we are of the view that all of the facilities and services to be regulated must equally be underpinned by such legislation. It is our view, honourable members, as you are aware, that the bill proposes that certain existing regulatory frameworks will continue to exist with some adjustment. And by way of example, this would include a continued existence of the Airport Company Act, the Air Traffic Navigation Services Company Act, the National Roads Act, and the National Ports Act. What is important to note is that these regulatory frameworks were enacted by Parliament to provide for very specific access and price regulation criteria and considerations that are uniquely applicable to the complexities of the market being regulated. As a result, for example, the price regulation for in the ERT bill is supplemented with very specific regulations in the case of determination of tariffs applicable to the airports company. Over and above Section 11, which regulates price control in the ERT bill, Section 12 of the Airports Company Act has very specific considerations that relate to the continued economic health of the airport system in South Africa that needs to be considered over and above what is provided for in Section 11 of the bill. Now, where we are right now, there is no National Railway Act. In other words, the railway sector doesn't benefit from the same degree of consideration and criteria in terms of price regulation that is unique to the complexities of the railway sector. This, although Chapter 2 of the Railway Bill provides for access to the railway network, the provisions of that chapter is insufficient to provide certainty regarding the expected outcome of economic regulation of the freight rail transport market as a whole. It is our view that the emphasis on regulating only dominant facilities and services may result in an unintended structural imbalance. It is thus our view, and we are calling for an equivalent National Railway Act to underpin economic regulation of railway facilities and services to coexist with the ERT Bill. I will illustrate to you in a minute the degree to which we believe the hybrid approach in the ERT Bill to have certainty in relation to services that are currently being regulated by very specific market or sector legislation and the generic introduction of price regulation to new regulated entities will only result in uncertainty and will have a material impact in the manner in which different modes of transport and regulated entities will have to compete for funding, affordable funding and access to funding to sustain the rail transport facilities and services. Honorable Chair, we believe that our view in this regard, albeit expressed in a slightly different, with a slightly different angle, has also been raised by previous speakers. We also believe that our position in this regard corresponds with the regulatory framework of, for example, the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, who regulates electricity pipelines and gas infrastructure and services within the framework of sector or market specific legislation, which was enacted by Parliament. The fact that the legislation had been enacted by Parliament provides for a clarity from the onset. And if we can move to the next slide, please. Provides for clarity from the onset on how all participants in that particular market will be regulated, both from a market access and tariffing perspective. We believe, Honourable Chairperson, that in other words, that the ERT Bill should regulate competitiveness holistically. In relation to the railway sector, it is our belief that the ERT Bill, supplemented with a National Railway Act, should focus on licensing of all railway facilities and services as a whole, and not principally only focus on regulating price control for dominant entities. It is our view that the licensing of all railway operators will be critical to ensure that all industry players understand their position and responsibilities within the sector. It is our view that licensing will promote accountability of all individual operators in the public interest and encourage effective and efficient working relationship, relationships between the individual industry players. It is our view that the regulator should strive to obtain and implement principles of capital maintenance, which is premised on full cost recovery plus the cost of capital maintenance. As it stands, Transnet is already struggling towards sustainably maintain the cost of providing rail network in a sustainable condition, having regard to the current economic and financial climate. It is our view, Honourable Chair, and this was also raised by other speakers, that there is a serious concern with regard to the considerable overlaps of the bill with the Competition Act and the mandate and scope of regulation provided for in this Act. It is our view that the transport economic regulator should leave the regulation of abuse of dominance to the Competition Commission, recognizing that over the years, the necessary expertise to regulate abuse of dominance has been well established with the Commission and the Tribunal, and that associated jurisprudence has been well established in that regard. Just to confirm, our view is that the transport economic regulator should focus on fair regulation of all participants in a sector to ensure that those participants are licensed and their license conditions apply equally across all participants in the relevant sector, and leave abuse of dominance to the Competition Commission. If we can go to the next slide, Chair, thank you. A matter that has also been raised, which we would like to give particular emphasis to, is our concern with the rising cost of economic regulation. In the railway sector, Transnet and other railway operators, network operators, are already subject to very steep regulatory fees in relation to or as imposed by the railway safety regulator. It is our view that the ERT bill will add a huge financial burden to regulated entities, especially if that burden is only carried by regulated dominant entities. It is our view that it does and will continue to have an impact on the cost of doing business. The ability to pass through those costs to customers will have a direct impact on us achieving our objective to reduce the cost of transport, to ensure that we remain competitive, globally competitive, especially as far as the transportation of export commodities are concerned. It is also our view that through the duplication and overlap of mandate between the Competition Commission, through the potential structural imbalances introduced by the inconsistent degree of regulatory certainty between the different modes of transport, that the objectives of the National Development Plan to reduce the cost of transport and logistics in the country will in fact be impaired. We do believe that we require clarity on the funding of the regulator to the extent that if the regulation, the ambit of regulation is going to be limited to only dominant firms, we believe that those dominant firms will carry a huge burden in terms of sustaining a structure, regulatory structure, which should be intended to be to the benefit of a sector as a whole. Chair, I will end our presentation at this point. Again, we wish to thank the committee for your time and attendance to this matter.
Thank you, you did indicate that there are board members that have joined you. Maybe they can just introduce themselves before we get into a participant question. And before we get to the question, just the introduction by the board members that are here from Transnet.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Popo Molepe. I'm chairman of the board of Transnet. My sincere apology. Had to go to a dentist for an emergency attention. I have just come back to join the meeting. And good morning to everybody, all the honorable members and the executive for Transnet and directors.
Thank you, Chairperson. The apology accepted. We appreciate your presence, Dr. Bulefe. Thank you. Are there other members?
Yes, good morning, Chairperson. My name is Dimaka Tsumakofa, and I'm a board member at Transnet as well. Thank you.
Other members? I guess those are the only members that we have from the board. Your presence is highly appreciated, and special word of appreciation to the chairperson. We will then move to the presentation by the Western Cape Government, Department of Mobility, Advocate Ricardo Collins.
Good day, Chair and honorable members, colleagues. Thank you very much. I'll just share my screen with you. You will let me know if it's visible, Chairperson.
It is indeed visible.
Thank you very much. Let's put it in slide mode. Thank you. And just as, you know, for the request of the Chairperson, perhaps just by way of introduction and that people can put a face to the name, I'm Advocate Ricardo Collins. I'm a director in the Mobility Department in the Western Cape Government and primarily responsible for land transport contracts within that particular department. Chairperson, I'm not going to take up a lot of the time, and I think perhaps it's the benefit or non-benefit of being last on the agenda that your colleagues would have covered substantially some of the comments that you've made. The presentation is really just a high-level overview of the comments that's been made by the department and does not seek to replace the comments made by the department, and our submission would be if the committee could kindly consider this in collaboration with one another, the presentation and the comments that's been made. We've largely covered, I think, Chairperson, just move to the next slide. So the presentation aims at this stage is to provide obviously an overview, which I would skip through, Chairperson, with your permission, given the overviews that has been discussed by previous presenters, just really to provide a high level and a highlight over the Western Cape government position, and trying to encapsulate the main motivations for its position, and also then provide some recommendations to the department in as far as it relates to the refinement of the bill. So just in terms of the purport, the only thing that I really want to highlight on this is that we note that this bill has been coming since 2018. During the previous iterations, the department did provide some input, and we are glad to see that some of this input has been taken up in the latest iteration of the bill, to really just enhance the applicability of it and deal with some of the challenges that we foresaw at this stage, at those particular stages. The province just want to commend obviously those improvements that has been made to the bill over the years, specifically and notably the broadening of the powers of the transport economic regulator, you know, at the behest of the ports regulator, you know, would likely be more effective regulation from our perspective, at least in this regard. While the ports regulator, in our minds, being currently funded by Treasury, it's one of the inputs that we've made was that we now see that, you know, the fees will be levied to be able to secure the sustainability of the economic regulator in this particular space, and that's captured in Clause 51. And then also lastly, the aspects that we raised with regards to the sharing of information specifically has also now been covered with the Promotion of Access to Information Act and also the Protection of Personal Information Act, which we saw highlighted in clause 2.5. So that we thank the department for those enhancements over this time. The position currently from the Western Cape government, while we support the objective of the bill as you know, put out in the memorandum, the current format of the bill unfortunately cannot be supported by the Western Cape government, and we'll try really on a high level basis to explain to you some of the challenges that we do foresee. So the recommendations and submissions that we've made really aims to do the following. We just want to focus very specifically on two clauses, which is clauses 4 and 11. And then there's some general comments that we want to make in terms of the approach to certain transport-related matters within the bill. And lastly, the area that I'm not covered, won't cover in here, but it is part of the presentation, is really just some of the legislative drafting concerns and language that may create confusion when read by a member of the public, and also perhaps even may create interpretation challenges moving forward in relation to the bill. So as part of the review of the bill in 2020, the province notes two clauses specifically, as I've indicated, clauses 4 and clauses 11. And while the province has prepared detailed recommendations on most of the clauses in the bill, the two of the above mentioned clauses will be specifically highlighted to you. We see the concerns, I think, raised by Sabowa, Mr. Governor, that was the first presenter, given what is specifically highlighted in Clause 4.2 of the Amendment Bill, and we just really want to be, highlight the preconditions of efficiency and cost effectiveness do not exist in the market concerned, where it speaks of the 70% of the market concerned. It is assumed that the current, at this stage at least, that the IPTNs as we know them may fall into the above category. And it's not clear really how the bill intends trying to deal with this specific element. We know that the municipalities, when they go through a tender process or a negotiated process in terms of the NLTA, the municipality sets a single tariff, although there may be multiple operators in a particular space. The same applies obviously to the public transport operations grant, and specifically in the Western Cape, Golden Arrow Bus Services is the single operator in this particular space. The nature of the current public transport industry is subsidized, is that subsidized services sometimes appear to compete with unsubsidized services. In reality, is that the subsidized service usually provides a minimum level of quality and reliability and the commerce dependability, which may not be evident in the unsubsidized service market. It would therefore be problematic to attempt to regulate the service where a single prescribed tariff may have an adverse outcome on the quality of the service provided. So just the recommendations from our side as the department, it is submitted that a more suitable proposal, one which would serve the purpose of introducing certain certainty, would be for a single declaration by the minister after consultation with the regulator that the listed regulators be incorporated into the regulator. So subsequent to the declaration by the notice in the Gazette, the relevant regulators are then given a three-year period within which to institute the necessary legislative reforms as it stands at the moment. The imposition of the regulations on a service which appears to be uncompetitive, but where in actual fact there are different levels of services being provided. So example, the supply-led service versus the scheduled demand-led service is hopefully catered for by clause 4.2, but note it may here of the risk of the minister imposing regulations without due consultation with the provincial and or the municipal authority in the area of the service. So the key thing here really is that that the new clause we would propose would be inserted, which makes it clear that the regulator must consult with the effective provincial and municipal authorities with respect to the services or entities that it's to be regulated in their particular area. This is really also on the back, Chairperson, of the fact that we currently sit, albeit not this committee, that deals specifically with issues of constitutionality when it comes to the National Land Transport Amendment Bill as well, that the various spheres of government claiming their space in particular areas when it comes to transport, and in this case particularly public transport, that we should not lose sight of the role that the provinces and municipalities should be playing in as far as it relates to this particular matter. Then really just in short, speaking to clause 11, it does not expressly provide for consultation with the effective spheres of government. It's something that we would certainly recommend. It is unclear from clause 11.1 whether the intention of the bill to regulate any transport-related fees or tariffs set by other spheres of government. This should be clarified. So there's just uncertainty and then obviously opportunity in that particular space for misunderstanding and or misinterpretation. So the recommendation also is that clause 11 be amended to require the regulator to consult, as I previously indicated, and it is also recommended that clarity be provided in the bill in this regard specifically. Moving further with regards to clause 11, the regulation and price determination should be avoided. Our view is that maximum prices and fees lead to supply shortages and increase in informal market activity. minimum prices, on the other hand, again, lead to the oversupply and higher prices to consumers. So regulating the pricing of transport entities and access to their infrastructure does not address the inefficiencies within these institutions. So the recommendation from our side would be from the department is, you know, other potential options for consideration and further investigation include forced breakups of monopolies, something I think Mr. Govender also alluded to in his presentation, by government and or to encourage more competition in this particular area. It is recommended that competition be introduced by granting concessions to private operators to utilize publicly created transport infrastructure, and in our particular case in the Western Cape, would include ports and rail. Further to clause 11, on our initial assessment, the clause appears too prescriptive in the way in which limits on regulates entities' ability to generate revenue and utilize returns from assets. This will, in our mind, again, discourage investment. And our recommendation from that perspective would be that the clauses relating to the limits on revenue and utilization on return be deleted. Alternatively, that they be revised to remove these limits. Close on finalizing on this particular topic, just highlighting on this specific slide the uncertainty that may be created with regards to definitions that's covered in clauses 1 and then, you know, spills over to clauses 11. When we speak of, for example, facilities and services, it creates, it's unclear to us at least, which facilities or services would be subject to the price regulation in this case, given the inaccuracies and or the definitions not speaking to each other. So amendment in this regard to provide clarity and all further elaboration would be required. Then just two other aspects that we will be covering, Chair, very briefly, is the personnel and organizational structure, the concessions to private operators, and then potential integration of regulator and related bodies into existing structures. The key element really in terms of the personnel is that we do not want to find ourselves in a situation where the taxpayer again gets overburdened by a new organizational structure for the regulator. Our motivation would be that we try and use existing human resources to staff and man the administration of the regulator to avoid creating over bloated or organizational structures which cause the further burden on the taxpayer. This is in line, I think, with the initial comments I think Dr. Clark made on behalf of the right in the first presentation, which speaks to the fact that there's quite a number of staff that will be required to man and highly skilled staff to man the responsibilities expected from the regulator in terms of this legislation. Just further comment in terms of concessions, following our comments in 2020, it's apparent the objectives of the memorandum on the objects of the bill, that the intention of the bill to address the following is the consequences of the current ills and of transport and transport infrastructure, the domination by large inefficient state-owned companies with a high degree of market power over infrastructure and services. So our recommendation from a provincial perspective would be is that the province submit that competition should be introduced by granting concessions to private operators to utilize public created transport infrastructure, as I've alluded to earlier, which includes ports and rail. It is recognized that the bill made some provisions for private sector participation, which we are supported and we believe can further be enhanced. Then potential integration. The bill envisages the establishment of the regulator with a panel and a board with various officers, the establishment of various bodies, and the appointment of officers should not become an additional burden to the taxpayer, while the bill attempts to address this by ensuring that the regulator is partly funded through levies against the industry, existing capacity should be used to staff the administration, as I previously alluded to. So then I think just from our side, Chair, the province continues to reiterate that the bill should consider establishing such bodies and making appointments within existing organizational structures. Chair, with your permission, the last slide I'm not going to go through really deals with some of the semantics that may create some interpretation problems moving forward in relation to this bill. And it's really just here for the benefit, I think, of the department and the drafters of the legislation. We've captured them in this presentation largely, and we've also captured them in our formal submissions that's been made to the committee. I think just in summary, then from our side is that the department, as I've indicated previously, unfortunately cannot support the bill in its current forms. And we really request that the inputs and the submissions made by the department and other role players and stakeholders in the space be considered seriously to ensure that if this bill is in fact passed, that it's something that's implementable, that would benefit the transport sector, and that the transport sector would indeed see a changed environment in which they are operating. So thank you very much, Chair, for this opportunity. Thank you very much, Committee.
Thank you, Honourable Thomas, for taking the committee through the province presentation. We will now probably then allow members to provide clarity seeking questions to the presenters. Announcing that I've noted TM Sandy Stark. Let's see any other members. Let's take TM for now. TM, the floor is yours. And then it will be then followed.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I appreciate the opportunity, and I want to just thank everybody for taking the time to present this morning to the committee, as you have, Chair. Chair, just a couple of questions. The first one is, and Chair, I don't know if it's possible just for the assistance of the presenters, for the document that I think Dr. Annika presented in the beginning, which is the summary of the supports and objections. If that could just be flattered, please. It will just help give context to my queries and help the presenters respond. If that could be done, please, if that's possible. And if we could just go to slide 14 on that once it's up.
Yes. Can I probably also then give a That was the summary of the...
It's the select committee summary.
Yes. Dr. Flack?
Yes, Chairperson, I'm loading it as you speak.
Brilliant. From Professor Muller.
Okay, yes. Well, thank you very much. If we could just go to slide 14. Okay, yeah, that's the one. I'm not sure. Okay, so Professor Muller put this together. I'm not sure which presenters this pertains to, but I just feel it would be useful if we could just, you know, that the top point there speaks to maximum prices or fees lead to supply shortages and increase in informal market activity, and then minimum prices lead to oversupply and higher prices to consumers. If we could just get a, if other, I don't know if Professor Muller's on the call or if any other presenters can comment on that, I would like to just get an understanding of the economics of that. How maximum prices and fees or minimum prices and fees lead to those outcomes. I think that would be very useful because I think it's obviously one of the main issues in this bill is an intention to try and, you know, protect the consumer. But, you know, economics is a factor that is sometimes not considered, and the economic factors that play out in market conditions can lead to the unintended consequences that that sometimes are not taken into account. So that's the first question. If either Professor Muller is on the call or if any other presenters want to have a stab at this, because I'm not sure which presentation this came from, it doesn't describe, you know, the particular submissions to each point. If somebody wants to have a stab at that, that's the first point. Then the second point, Chair, is the issue of the funding model for this regulator. The question, there's reference to levies from industry players supporting the regulator. But we all know that if, you know, there's talk about no impact on the taxpayer. Well, you know, industry players are also taxpayers. And if they have to, if their bottom line goes up, increases in cost, they will pass that on to the consumer. That will happen. So my question is, and I don't know whether this would be better reserved for next week to the department, but maybe one of the presenters or all of the presenters have an idea of whether or not a feasibility study is being done on a percentage basis. The establishment of the regulator would require a amount of per regulator, and what percentage impact that could have on a simple thing like fares or prices that commuters have to pay. In other words, to actually understand the actual knock-on that that's going to have on the man or the woman in the street who's paying for a fare to commute somewhere. And then my final question, Chairperson, is on slide 16, if Dr. Anika could just go there, please. And it refers to the constitutional provisions that deal with intergovernmental cooperation. And I believe it refers to these sections that say that spheres of government are independent, but obviously interrelated and interdependent, but says that they are distinct and unique, and that one sphere cannot tell another sphere effectively what to do. And therefore, it brings into, and once again, I don't know which submission this pertains to, because unfortunately the document doesn't describe it, but it relates to the possible unconstitutionality of 41.1b and 41.1c. Because they could create an unconstitutional environment where one sphere is telling another sphere how to operate. If anybody on the call can comment on that, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, Chair. That's all I have for now.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Professor. Let's keep over to Honorable Khai.
Thank you very much, President. Let me just indicate that at the time the presentation was made by the department to the committee, it was a time that I was hospitalized. So I try to look at the go through the presentation, it was not that detailed. I had to then download the bill itself, just to have an idea what this bill is all about. So therefore, I won't have many questions, Chair. I just have two. I just want to find out from with regard to Transnet, if you look at the bill, but also the presentation, it talks about the consultation process that it embarked upon, and amongst the stakeholders, it includes Transnet, but also the fact that this bill was approved by the cabinet, and there's a minister who's responsible for Transnet who sits in cabinet. The issues that they are raising during their consultation, what was the outcome of those consultations in terms of their views or their submissions, but also the fact that without this concern that they are raising, why did it go through the cabinet processes? That's one question, but also to Transnet as well as Saboa and maybe the Western Cape government. I just want to check, because I'm looking at the section that deals with the application of the Act, Section 4, whether Saboa, Transnet and other stakeholders, whether they are not accommodated by that particular section, which is about the application of the Act that talks to issues of exemption, especially the point that was raised by Saboa that there are contracting authorities that regulate issues that will be regulated by the TER. Those are the two questions that I want to clarity on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Honorable Khan. So the hand of Honorable Matebula. Okay, let me check. It looks like let me check the questions on the chat. Can we ask the committee secretary to go through those questions of Honorable Matebula?
Thank you, Chair Pepper. The questions read as follows. Question to South Africa bus operators. One, will this bill benefit, cover or provide infrastructure that will increase accessibility and provide integrated transport system for located in the rural areas? Two, what effect will this bill have on the cost of transport in our country for ordinary citizens? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Committee Secretary. The first one from my side, from Saboa. The second I get from Saboa is that the bill will have an impact in terms of the freedom to contract. That's the impression that I get, particularly in relation to the sector specific, given the contracting space that to a larger degree regulate the industry-specific of course, there's an area which captures the need to deal with the monopoly, because if you look at one of the aspects that is dealt with is the small and medium enterprise development, which is raised as an entry point. There is a reflection that in most cases these contracts will be between 2 to 7 and 12 years. So the only good question that one would want to ask is as to whether has this consideration been factored into in terms of the need to open up the industry. Of course, one is also mindful of the views expressed, which I suspect it cuts across all the presentation. The suggestions that there is to a larger degree an overlap between the work of the Competition Commission and also the regulator, has been raised. But I think the issues around the assertion that the regulation, the bill itself is a drastic intervention, particularly with regard to price control, the assertion that it is massive, the assertion that it will have unintended consequences. This is the message that is cutting across all the presentation. The sense that one gets is that the presenters are saying that the bill is introducing an extra red tape in terms of the industry, and that it has to be confronted. But of course, mindful of the fact that the thrust, as one suspects, is that the also confront the monopoly within the industry. And you also say that as an extra red tape, it could also discourage investors to invest in the industry. It would be important just to get a sense in terms of the presenters, whether it's is this a common threat, are they sharing the common threat around this? But I think the other point that one wanted to propose to Sandra is the because one get a sense that there is an outcry for a national rail legislation similar to what is prevailing in the airports, similar to what is happening in the energy sector, similar to what is happening in the water authority. Probably, there has been an attempt to kickstart that through the department. Other than that, I think let's allow the presenters just to share their views in terms of the issues that are raised. But of course, appreciating the fact that the department will have an opportunity to present in the next meeting, and also the legal services unit of the parliament will also have an opportunity to give us a response to the issues that are canvassed by all the presenters today. Let's start first here with the Aboa. Aboa.
Thank you, Chair. I'll go in the order of the way the questions came in. So starting with you, Chair, I think because you by order of privilege, we will start with you. We are fully cognizant of the barriers to entry, and this is pretty much a self-created conundrum. Barriers to entry for new operators are huge, and in many aspects, the way the contracting environment is set out actually limits the entry of new operators because of size, scale, geography, and access to finance, and many aspects. So, how the regulatory entity can add to that. From our perspective, is that we've been grappling with this for 3 decades. So, as a measure of creating sustainability and continuity in public transport, vis-a-vis the road-based passenger subsidized contract, the model tender document is what sets out how tenders are to be put to market. And therein also has been some pretty glaring avenues that were open to challenge, legal challenge, in the way they've been set out and implemented by various entities, i.e. provinces and or contracting authorities, to the extent that the process does not gain any traction for transformation and transition of public transport. So yes, and then again, on the flip side, is to develop a process that makes it possible for new entrants to enter the market, because there are certain ways and mechanisms for new entrants to enter via a consortium, which has access to funding and capital that allows them to play in the space. But ultimately, and it ties back to impact, if you don't get certainty, you can't invest. Because CapEx is a long-term game, medium to long-term. Finance houses, for example, buses are depreciated generally in the region of, or paid off generally in the region of 5 years over the financing aspect, but depreciated anywhere between 8 to 15 years, depending on the mechanism. So all those things coming together in an uncertain environment currently, and our view is right from the beginning, we support the process of the regulatory entity, but it's the mechanisms that are being proposed that require a little bit of debate and perhaps a lot more discussion. And flowing through to Honorable Matavula's questions, whether it will benefit cover provide infrastructure. All of those issues are entangled in the questions and queries that we submitted. And, for example, sitting alongside and interspersed in all the discussions are various policies, fantastic policies, sound policies, but lacking in implementation, Chair. Your National Public Transport Subsidy Policy speaks to dealing with issues around or addressing issues around rural transport, integrated transport, the subsidization of households that need access to safe transport in the main. So what effect will the bill have on the cost of transport? It's too easy to say. But if I tie that back to Honorable Brautaseth, I hope I've said your name correctly, sir. Question around the funding.
Brautaseth,
yes. Around the funding.
Thank you.
Yes, we have no idea how many entities will fall within the regulatory space, first of all. We'd have to get a database of everybody that qualifies to be a regulated entity, then have discussions around what is the cost of the regulator spread into a number of entities. But those are all discussions that still need to happen, Chair. I think I've covered Honorable Rai's question around Section 4. I think we've got detailed questioning and we'd look to see what the responses are because we've contextualized it against current contracted regime that is very, very, very well set out. And we just wanted to know, is this going to be a deferred accountability to the entity, the regulatory entity, or will it be retained at government and or at, depending where the contracting authority sits at municipality? And I think there's a space for a more, and Mr. Dax has indicated he's representing the Transport Authority of Gauteng, which is one of the more established currently proposed contracting authorities, and Mr. Collins, Collins in the Western Cape. So, but for the main part, in many areas, we don't have formally defined contracting authorities. So there's a bit of a looseness. As such, we don't have integrated transport plans that talk to holistic transport networks and sustainable public transport. So a regulator coming in, whilst is the right principled approach, will have a very onerous task of navigating all of these challenges that we've been navigating for 3 decades. And in it, it talks to some of the challenges we've experienced around intergovernmental accountability. We just find currently, without a regulatory entity, the immersion of accountability between government departments and tiers of government is highly problematic towards managing public transport. So those are the comments in response to you, Chair. I hope I've done that justice.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mr. Governor. Let's go to an reflection from Gauteng.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I think we as I put in our submission, it's very important to distinguish between, let's call it social services or social infrastructure, and I would put public transport in that area, and economic infrastructure where Transnet would find its space. So the thought of subsidizing economic services and infrastructure, I think, doesn't make sense. So any impact which comes from this regulator changing prices in terms of that economic infrastructure, with it impact on the business of Transnet? And I'm saying this in my simplistic understanding of the impacts that would come. When it comes to public transport, though, the costs of operating the services have to be covered by the fares which people pay and the subsidy which government pays. Now, assuming that we can become more efficient and reduce costs to become, that more perfect operating system in public transport, it will become a straight balancing act. It will be that for every rand in fare that is reduced, there will be a rand increased in terms of the subsidy. And that's where our concern from a public contracting agency comes from. But yeah, and I think the point was made in the first question, what about the laws of supply and demand? So in other words, if the fares were reduced to a point where demand for the services then increased, it might impose even more costs on public authorities to provide more rail or more bus services to cater for that increased demand. And to support what Mr. Governor is saying,
This would all happen in the context of very limited integrated transport planning. So here we are in a very complex environment trying to, I think, make sense of good principles that we all support in the bill in terms of improving efficiency and effectiveness, cost effectiveness, but putting it on quite a chaotic environment at the moment, if I may speak very frankly. And that's what the point that we are trying to make when we say the law of unintended consequences may apply here. So, Chair, maybe just to close off with that final sort of rand for rand analogy, and I think it was the question from one of the honourable members, will bus users get lower costs? Quite probably, Chair. Will they get better services? Would have to remain to be seen. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Let's give over to Western Cape.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think there was really two questions addressed, and thank you for Dr. Clark has also put it in the chat. Two questions addressed us really dealing with the aspect of constitutionality, which we've raised, and then also the economics put around this. I'm not going to attempt to answer the economics one, Chair, in as far as those representations has been given by our provincial treasury. And with your permission, I would ask them rather just really in a short paragraph, perhaps just to elaborate that with Dr. Clark, if the member would be happy with that situation. I am a lawyer by profession, so I can try and convince you on something, but I wouldn't want to do it in this particular space. So with your indulgence, Chair, I'll ask if I can just get a paragraph to Dr. Clark on that specific topic. With regards to the constitutionality aspect that the member has put forward, it really has to do with the fact that in terms of the constitution, if you look at the legislative capabilities of provinces specifically, this act would quite squarely fall within Schedule 4 of the Constitution, which allows for the legislative authority to be put at the provincial level. Now, with this particular bill, in clauses, I think 41, speaks of the fact that the regulator, through this bill, would then recommend amendments to the province to the existing legislation, which in our minds may trample upon the ability or may trample upon the functionality of a province to exercise their right to legislate freely on specific items which falls within their legislative mandate in terms of the constitution. Now, to take that just a little bit further, is that if there is any conflict, perhaps, or the regulator identifies that there's conflict between national legislation and perhaps something that it picks up in provincial legislation, then there's a different mechanism and a constitutional mechanism that should be followed to ensure that either the provincial legislation is amended and or which of the legislation would suffice in this particular circumstances, specifically referring to section 146 and 147 of the Constitution. So we are just concerned that section is encouraging the regulator to opt and encourage provinces to amend their legislation while there is in fact a constitutional mechanism that allows for any conflict that may exist or a potential amendment that may need to be attended to in terms of the constitution. And that's why we raised that specific point with regards to that. I think that was the only two points, Chairperson, that fell on our lab for response. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Let me then give over to Transnet. So we had yes, Mr. Sandra, you can check the floor.
thank you, Chairperson. I don't want to usurp your authority, so I apologize if I interrupted or started too soon. Chairperson, and I would like to invite any one of my colleagues who are online to supplement my statement.
Let's check whether the chairperson has anything to say. Because now that he's here, I think he's one that must be engaged. Dr. Mulepe? It looks like Dr. Mulepe.
No, Chairperson, I have got nothing to add at this stage. Thank you very much.
I thought you'll respond to that slide in terms of the interface between the political principle of DPME and the Minister of Transport in terms of the question that was posed by Honorable Khai in relation to the fact that normally when the bill is referred to Parliament, it could have should have served at the cabinet level. It should have been referred to, meaning that all the relevant authorities, meaning that in this instance, the expectation is that Transnet should have been consulted as part and parcel of the process towards the cabinet endorsing the bill and then referring it to Parliament. Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I really would be cautious not to throw the pigeon the cat amongst the pigeons. It is proper that indeed, to the extent that legislation or policy is being developed, which cuts across more than one department or institution, or even impact entities, that the process of consultation should be one that permeates all of those entities and departments that are affected. We have endeavored as Transnet in a number of respects to engage the various political authorities affected, be they Department of Transport or Department of Public Enterprises. Indeed, you know, it does happen on occasion that when a particular department in its endeavor to develop policy and probably to move rapidly to meet their timelines, things fall through the cracks, they leave others behind, and we have warned that the last thing you want is to run ahead of everyone else. At the end, when you want to implement, we suddenly start raising difficulties with the policy instrument that you have developed, which is something that can be pretty embarrassing and quite often then result in litigations, as we have seen, where, you know, the constitutionality of the law or the fairness of the bill is being questioned. But we are where we are now. We have through our legal department, Sandra there, and the group chief executive, been engaging on both sides of the Department of Transport and Department of Public Enterprises. And I've made this general statement, but one instance that has demonstrated amply that sometimes to rush to legislate without having followed processes and considered implications cause problems. A case in point is that, you know, we passed legislation in 2005 that the Transnet National Ports Authority would become a standalone company. But there were a broad range of implications which had not been considered, like 18 years later, we have not been able to fully implement that law. We're pushed as Transnet with the Department of Transport and Public Enterprises, but there are serious snags because some of these things you legislate within the context in which the company has entered into contracts, borrowing contracts with various funding authorities, and the basis of those contracts is this complete balance sheet, for example. Now you're saying you pass a law that says take out Transnet National Ports Authority, it must be a standalone company. You can't, because before you deal with that, you must say, if the Transnet National Ports Authority contributes approximately 70 billion rand to the balance sheet of Transnet, are you going to immediately get the state to the government to provide that 70 billion rand so that Transnet can then pay the lenders so that it does not end up in breach of the loan covenant? So it is these sorts of things, Chairperson, that needs to be considered and before any piece of legislation is passed. But and it means, therefore, consultation broadly would enable the parties involved to understand the risks that are attended to the legislation that is envisaged. I'm giving just a general response, but just to say that indeed it is important that deeper consultations take place, that in so doing we obviate any possibility of legislation that would be deficient. But that process is continuing from our side.
Thank you, Dr. Malepe. Can we then give over to Sandra?
Thank you, Chairperson. I will just add to the response to Honorable Rai's question.
Honorable Rai.
Rai, my apologies. Chairperson. Chairperson, indeed, we have engaged in various consultations with the Department of Transport, and we have communicated, as I stated in my introduction, that Transnet is not resisting the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill. Transnet is not resisting regulation. So we want to just clarify that. What we are saying is that to ensure that the complexities associated with the regulation of the railway sector, which has hitherto not been regulated, should equally be underpinned by sector-specific regulation that will recognize that which is unique to that sector, and that should inform decision-making by the regulator to ensure that the sector is regulated fairly, and that the sector is regulated in a manner that is economically sustainable. Now, as we speak, and I gathered that you were alluding to the possibility of the department kickstarting a National Railway Act, we're calling for that because we believe that would ensure that at the end, all modes are regulated in a similar fashion with equal attention to those criteria and considerations, especially with regard to price control regulation that is unique to that particular mode or sector. So with regard to the question on exemption, yes, it could assist, but again, we want to reiterate that Transnet, although we believe that exemption will provide the space to get the National Railway Act in place, we are not resisting regulation. We do not want to signal that we resist third-party access and regulation of associated access fees. We just want to be treated equally in relation to the unique circumstances that we find ourselves in, so that we can ensure that we're sustainable.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Sandra, for that response. I guess members are fine now. In terms of process moving forward, like as we indicated, we will, in the next meeting, receive the response from both the department and also the legal services unit of Parliament. And then following that, we will then allow the processes to move forward. But what will be quite critical is to take this opportunity to indeed express a word of appreciation on behalf of the Senate Committee on Transport for the honoring of the invitation by the stakeholders that took part in today's meeting, upon the invite that we extended to the public to express their views, which is quite critical, because public participation is the hallmark of our constitutional democracy. The number of court judgments has expressed their views in relation to a failure to enable the public to participate. So indeed, your participation is highly, highly appreciated, and let me take this opportunity to thank you to honoring this invite. Meeting is free to exit the meeting as we deal with the in-house agenda amongst the minutes. So let's check with the committee secretary our minutes of the last meeting. Thank you, Chairperson Mlefe, for honoring our invite and your board, Western Cape, Gauteng, and also Sabua. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings, everybody. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chairperson and Committee. Chairperson, are we released?
You are released, Dr. Mlefe.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you very much. Do I log out now? Okay, let me see.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Chairperson, may I just ask a quick question, which is related to the committee?
Yes, Honorable Professor.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just wanted to ask, the submissions that were listed in the summary document, were those the only submissions received on the bill? And then secondly, we didn't receive that Western Cape submission that was put on the screen by the presenter from the Western Cape. Can we please get that submission as well, please? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Dr. Clark presented on the written submission that was not able to make an oral presentation today. Is that correct, Dr. Clark?
Yes, that is correct, Honorable Chairperson. And to answer Member Bottesef's question, those were the only written submissions we received on the bill, the ones that was listed in my presentation, Chairperson.
Brilliant. So,
thank you, Chairperson. But I did see that the I think it was Advocate Ricardo Collins, he seemed to have a document in front of him that he shared on the screen. And I don't think we received that submission.
It was sent there today.
Oh, it was sent today. Okay.
Yeah, it's in the morning.
Yeah. Thank you, Honorable Khan.
Thank you. I remember the minutes of the 31st of May, 2023. It was on our submission on two bills. Those are the members that were present. Any correction thereof? Guests in attendance. And then the parliamentary staff that were present, we were an acting committee secretary in place. And then those are the opening and apologies and then the proceeding, how it unfolded. Read by Dr. Clark and then the Professor Perry, then Mr. Park. Reflection and then deliberation by committee members. Okay, good. Those were the last presentation just from SALGA. Deliberation today. And then the agenda at 11:30. Any correction? In the absence of that, can we then get a mover for the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection?
I move chair for the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Professor. Thank you, Honorable Professor, for seconding. Therefore, the minutes are duly adopted. Just in terms of the process moving forward, Dr. Clark, so that it is the clarity.
In respect of the bill, Chairperson?
Yes.
So on the 14th of June, that's next week, the department assisted rather together with our legal advice from Parliamentary Legal Services. Will provide responses to the written and oral submissions received on the bill. Today, you will recall that after there was a request from certain provinces, approval was granted for the extension of the legislative cycle. So it will only be after the recess period, Chairperson, that the committee will reconvene again in respect of the consideration of the negotiating and the final mandate.
Thank you, Dr. Clark, for that clarity. And then the next engagement on this will be on the 14th. Let's then allow the members to prepare themselves to go to the plenary. If there's no any other issues that members would want to raise, I believe that we dealt sufficiently with our unbound mission yesterday in our sister committee, so there's no need while we allow the the parliamentary staff to continue engaging with DERCO. Is that the assertion correct? I guess I'm correct on that. Let's then take this opportunity to extend a word of gratitude to all the honorable members and also the staff from the department for attending the meeting, and also our parliamentary staff, the PMG, and the media team from Parliament for attending the meeting. So therefore, the meeting is formally closed and adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.